Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, 8th of May, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today, we have Vanessa Bailey from Damascus and Charles Mallett. Welcome to the programme both. Now, we're going to get kicked off today with the news that AstraZeneca has decided to withdraw its COVID-19 vaccine. At this point, they're claiming that the reason for the withdrawal is that the virus has mutated. It's no longer, the vaccine that they produced is no longer effective against SARS-CoV-2. And they're denying absolutely that it's got anything to do with their recent admission, finally, that the AstraZeneca vaccine had caused so much harm to many people. On the BBC this morning, for example, they were very, very keen to make sure that, at least the BBC was, to make sure that they reinforced the notion that it was a very rare event. And then they went on to celebrate the speed at which the vaccine had been developed in the first place. But nonetheless, AstraZeneca at this point denying still that the decision to withdraw it from globally, in fact, was anything to do with adverse reactions. So, that's one piece of news. The other piece of news is that the government is moving ahead with its narrative over the issue of antibiotics and so on. So if you remember last year, the UK Health Security Agency held their conference in November in Leeds, and the issue of antimicrobial resistance was high up on the agenda. So here's Jenny Harries, who at the time was saying, "I'm here to highlight the risk to everyone's health of antimicrobial resistance and call upon all partners to join the AMRSOS. So the government now has decided that they are going to, I've jumped ahead there, I do apologise. They've decided that they are going to roll out their new national action plan, sorry for the delay on that, on antimicrobial resistance, which they say has been launched to protect people and animals from the risk of drug-resistant infections. And this is in support of the government's 20-year vision to contain and control antimicrobial resistance by 2040. So this plan, they say, builds on the progress made in the previous five-year national action plan and lessons learned from COVID-19 and sets ambitious targets to drive down inappropriate use of antibiotics and stimulate further development of new drugs and vaccines. Well, you got the preview of it. Dame Sally Davis, in fact, didn't say anything about cleansing or baby wipes in this particular release, but I just remind everybody what she had said with respect not to antimicrobial resistance, but to Novichok, the nerve agent. In fact, what she said in this instance is, it's incomprehensible for any of us to imagine a world without effective antibiotics, but we're facing an antibiotic emergency already. Now, of course, she wrote the book on this several years ago, and she has been pushing this narrative for a very long time. But let's go back to the government's plan now and have a look at what they're saying. This new action plan will run from 2024 to 2029. It embeds lessons from the COVID-19 pandemic and will include specific commitments focusing on infection prevention and control and the development and use of diagnostics and vaccines. So in other words, they're rolling out the COVID plan with not only with respect to so-called viral pandemics, but also the issue of this. So they went on to say this, the National Action Plan will commit the UK to reducing its use of antimicrobials, such as antibiotics, antifungals and antivirals in humans and animals. It commits to continue to innovate through initiatives such as indicating that the world's first subscription model for antimicrobials, which was launched in 2019 as a pilot, could be expanded. So they are consulting on this at the moment. So what they have done is they've said that, well, we appreciate that antimicrobial drugs of various kinds have a value for the National Health Service. And so we are going to pay the big pharma companies a yearly subscription based on what we judge is the value to the NHS of these types of drugs. In the meantime, they're working as hard as they possibly can to reduce the use of these drugs. And so that brings us into a position where the NHS is potentially paying for something which it actually isn't receiving, because they're on a fixed subscription model and the quantity of the drug that's being used isn't taken into account for this. Charles, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this, but I'm not trying to downplay the issue of antimicrobial resistance or the overuse of antibiotics, particularly. I mean, antibiotics are overused. There's no question about that. They're taken like sweets by many people, and they're certainly used in the farming industry a bit too much. But nonetheless, this issue is being used, it seems to me, or looks to me like it's being used to build the same type of narratives for the type of behavioral control that we saw under COVID.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. And I would argue with Sally Davis that I can absolutely see a world in which we do not have antibiotics. And indeed, I think that's the world that we should be in. But this is, as you say, this is effectively conjoining the control money and fear narratives for the benefit of all those that are pulling those particular strings.
Yes. So in the meantime, we seem to have a new outbreak of some kind of nasty disease coming into farm animals?
We do, or at least that's the way the government would have it. If you are a human, though, don't switch off now, because this does definitely concern you. This is the government announcing that blue tongue is going to be a risk for this year. It's amazing forecasting by them. But they've suggested that due to some identification via tests, that this is what's going to be making a serious impact now. Of course, the BBC are fanning the flames with news that midges are being blown into the UK. So I think the inconsistent science is the theme running through this. The BBC reporting that a new strain of the animal disease could have a devastating impact. They talk about infected midges being blown over from Northern Europe. 126 cases. However, they're very clear that the virus does not affect people or food safety. And I'll come back to that, because I believe that is not true, even if for a slightly separate reason. And they critically, they say that farmers are calling for a vaccine. They go on to say that in the Netherlands, a vaccine was given emergency approval just last week, and that the government is actively engaging on this. Now, interesting to note that it was only in February here, according to the Farmer's Guide, that farmers were relieved, as blue tongue spread was now highly unlikely. So what's not been considered at all are the environmental conditions, which is often the case when the government attempting to determine a particular illness via testing. They take no regard for the environment. And of course, the consistently wet conditions over the winter are not just outstanding conditions for midges to hatch, breed, and circulate in, but also more likely to be depleting the nutrient supply of animals that have probably been kept indoors far longer than they would normally have been, on feed that they wouldn't normally be eating at this time of year. So to leap to the conclusion that midges are causing this or have anything to do with it is quite staggering. Nonetheless, we'll have a look at a quick video now to see what the government are saying about this.
AFA's role in controlling blue tongue is that we have the responsibility for controlling animal disease in Great Britain. It's our job to detect cases as they come through, so farms and vets will report suspicion of disease to us. We'll then go out and look at those animals. We'll take the samples, send them to Pirbright. They are the lead laboratory for blue tongue.
So the Pirbright Institute has a wide range of expertise, ranging from not only the laboratory testing aspect, but also around modelling of disease outbreaks, cuticoidal surveillance, and really supporting disease control. So they're now really preparing ourselves for an outbreak later this year, spread by the Culicordis midge, and is able to infect all known ruminant species, including cattle, sheep, goats, and camelids.
It's important to know that it only takes one infectious bite from a midge in order to infect an animal.
Classic clinical signs of blue tongue in sheep are edema of the face, fever, hemorrhage of the coronary bands. They'll be lethargic, may not want to get up to feed.
We've also worked with Pirbright on the modelling of the disease. What's the most likely scenarios? What's the least likely scenarios? And then also with the Met Office as well, to look at when is it likely that midges would be blown over from the continent. And we have a regular programme of assessing the risk of infected midges being blown into the UK.
Now, the problem is that a lot of people will receive what they've just heard there as absolute fact, and I would put it a different way. You will have noticed the many references to modelling and testing and midges being blown onto the continent, from the continent, for which there is scant, if any, evidence. Nonetheless, they are determined, of course, that there will be an effect on the animal population, and I would wager it'd only be a matter of time before the inference is drawn that humans are also at risk. But we'll just look at the financial background, because this is always where these things become a bit more clear. And the Sustainable Farming Initiative, which we've looked at a lot this year, talks about the annual health and welfare review. In essence, they are sponsoring farmers to have visits from vets. They say at the moment that this will not be used for inspections or compliance, but I wonder how long that will be the case, and that the vet will help you make sure your use of veterinary medicines and vaccines is appropriate, by which they mean that all animals must be vaccinated against absolutely everything all the time. So they're delivering these priorities by using public funds to pay for health and welfare enhancements that are valued by the public. Of course, the public are being told exactly what they should be valuing in the first place, and that they will therefore be purchasing food that aligns with their values. Now, this animal health and welfare pathway financially rewards farmers who deliver public goods, or at least that's the way they put it. So what do they mean by this? Well, we've got items and specifications under the Equipment and Technology Fund, and it doesn't take much searching to find that one such item is an automatic vaccination gun for livestock, which will be, you will be granted half the cost of that, and indeed a vaccine refrigerator with an external monitor. Critically, there underlined is the score, and you can increase your application score by 20% if you provide evidence that you've discussed your application with a vet. So it's very hard to see how any objectivity is really going to be retained throughout this process, as everybody chases the medicines and the money at the same time, because of course they both point in the same direction. Now, this comes from further back, which is the GB Blue Tongue Virus Disease Control Strategy, going back to 2014, in which there is a passage on vaccination. But specifically, what I want to point out is that it refers to the use of approved inactivated vaccines, and it talks about voluntary or compulsory vaccination under a specific or general license. So this is beginning to ring a fair few bells. The vaccine in question, the one that was referred to in the Netherlands, is here listed by the European Medicines Agency as the Sivazul BTV. And going back to the part about it being relevant for humans, what I want to draw your attention to is this passage here. First of all, the inherent arrogance of the allopathic medical system, which says that it teaches the immune system, which is the body's natural defenses, which seems to be a bizarre thing to want to do in the first place. But at the bottom there, the vaccine also contains adjuvants, aluminium hydroxide and saponin, that enhance the response of the immune system. So just bear that in mind whilst we look at the next bit, which is the withdrawal period from in food-producing animals. So this is the period before which an animal may be slaughtered for the meat being used for human consumption. And here, the withdrawal period for this drug with those adjuvants for sheep and cattle treated with this vaccine is 0 days, which means that there is no mandatory waiting time. It means that if you're eating food from a supermarket, there is absolutely no doubt that you are going to be eating these vaccines an awful lot besides. And it just goes to show how the system is being completely manufactured in order to follow Mike's segment. There is a complete reliance on these drugs and the money that's going both ways in the same system.
Charles, the theme here is, I think, from the beginning of the program, is we're starting to see the same types of policy cropping up in various different areas, whether it be a viral pandemic like COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, antimicrobial resistance. But you're talking about farm animals. We've got to remember that the same type of modelling and the same type of policy was rolled out during the foot and mouth crisis. And we had the whole issue of slaughtered on suspicion at that time, where you know, a test was given or a test result came back the wrong way. Farms found their entire herds being culled. So first of all, what are the symptoms of this? What are the implications for the animals? But I mean, do you also see any hints of a slaughtered on suspicion policy being sitting in the background here somewhere?
First of all, the slaughtered on suspicion, I'm not sure that I have seen anything that refers specifically to that. I think one of the reasons for that is that there's more money in not slaughtering on suspicion, or at least more money for the people that are able to exert more influence, and therefore the push towards medication is a more likely outcome. But I, as I say, because we're having this relentless push for what are being referred to as zoonotic pathogens, the idea, the sort of fear that if our biosecurity is not sufficient, then these things will go from animals to humans. And of course, as anyone who's ever been to the west coast of Scotland in the summer knows, midges do like biting humans too. So it's not going to be too long before the suggestion, perhaps, that that we're vulnerable to this as well. The symptoms, again, with all of these supposedly insect-borne illnesses, they are very non-specific. The blue tongue is the only really sort of, I mean, not actually that it's necessarily needs to be blue, but the sort of lethargy and general symptoms are in a way similar to the nondescript symptoms that malaria or dengue fever or any of these other things have attached to them. So as I said at the beginning, the science behind this is terrifically inconsistent and, of course, laboratory-driven and very, very closed-loop thinking.
Yes, okay. Thank you. We'll keep an eye on this as we go. Okay, let's move then to Vladimir Putin, because he has now been inaugurated earlier in the week for his fifth term as president of Russia. And it was quite the event. Now, the interesting thing here is that the list of countries that sent any kind of representation from the West was pretty small. So France, Hungary, Slovakia, Malta, Cyprus, and Greece sent representation, but everybody else decided that they didn't want to be involved in it at all. What fascinated me was the BBC's response to this in particular, because and in fact, the mainstream media as a general rule was really going with the ad hominem attacks here, of course. But Putinism is a thing, according to the BBC, and they were quoting a guy from the Carnegie Eurasia Russia Center saying, "We have one more ism in our history, Stalinism." I would say that Putinism is one more incarnation of Stalinism. He behaves like Stalin. His power is personalized, like in Stalin's time. He prefers to use a lot of political repressions. And like Stalin, he's ready to keep himself in power until the physical end. And then they attempted to demonstrate the sort of totalitarian. In fact, they were very clear in saying that this was not authoritarianism. It was totalitarianism that we were seeing here. And they attempted to demonstrate this by choosing one town in Russia that happens to have a mural on a wall of Putin. They may have been more successful with this argument if Putin murals had been in every single wall in every single town in the country. But anyway, nonetheless, this was the effort. Vanessa, it's really pretty childish, isn't it? Sorry, try again. We didn't hear you. Are you muted at your end? Okay, we have a problem then, because you're definitely not coming across here. So I think you need to try to reconnect. We will come back to this story in a minute. Let's see if we can do some quick editing and move forward through the
I'm back.
Ah, well done.
Oh, okay. I don't know what happened.
Anyway, tell us your thoughts on the coverage of the Putin thing.
You know, there is an increased number of Westerners that have moved to Russia to escape the totalitarianism in their own countries in the West. And to hear this kind of, as you say, ad hominem attack, when I'm clearly in touch with people who are now living in Russia, who have an incredibly relaxed lifestyle there. It's just insane.
It is. And I would echo that, because we had somebody visited us a couple of weeks ago who is a British guy living in Russia. He was very clear on what life in Russia is like for Westerners. It's quite incredible. But in the meantime, at around the same time, President Xi Jinping decided to head to France?
Well, actually, he's on a trip to Europe for the first time in 5 years, which is very interesting timing. Yesterday, he was in Belgrade, 25 years after the NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during their, devastation of Serbia. And here we just have some of the images of the visit by Xi Jinping and his wife to Paris and meeting with President Macron and our dear Ursula von der Leyen, who particularly made it very clear that this is about what they call balancing trade with China. In other words, I think curtailing what they perceive as Chinese trade expansion, overproduction of products and basically an invasion, I'm quite sure they perceive it as that, of European trade areas. Now, I found it quite funny that how Reuters reported what was discussed. First of all, the Chinese tariffs could leave cognac makers, particularly French, with too much brandy. What is this based on? Basically, high Chinese tariffs on EU brandy would leave French companies with vast amounts of cognac that could be hard to sell elsewhere. I didn't actually know that China was such a large market for cognac, but there you go. Anyway, also quite amusing is that Macron's gift to Xi Jinping was a vintage brandy. And then secondly, the companies invest in electric vehicle battery factories in Europe. This again is to counter the influence of Asia, particularly China, in production of these batteries. So this goes back to Europe is seeking to attract electric vehicle battery makers. Now, we all know how reliable those are, to build factories in the region, home to car makers such as Volkswagen and Stellantis, as it tries to cut dependency on Asia and win in the green race against the United States. Now, while he was there, Xi Jinping penned an article for Figaro, one of the leading media outlets in France. And the article was translated by the State Council, the English section, so the full text of his article. And I just picked out a couple of sections that I found particularly interesting. I know, Mike, you've also got your opinion having read it. I do recommend that everyone reads it. It's a very interesting read and certainly far weightier, far more intellectually interesting than much of what is produced by Western leaders and representatives. So one thing that I haven't included here is his comment about Israel-Palestine, and a slight softening, in my opinion, on the insistence on a two-state solution. He actually mentions the fact that this plan has now very much been eroded by events since the 7th of October. That's the first time that I've seen any kind of drift away from what I consider to be a complete political construct of a two-state solution towards a Palestinian state, but not necessarily adhering to the kind of two-state solution canard. But he also talked about Ukraine, the crisis on the people of Europe. He made that very clear. China did not start the Ukraine crisis, nor is it a party or a participant in it. Nonetheless, China has been playing a constructive role in striving for peaceful settlement. I've made many appeals, among others, observing the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, respecting sovereignty and territorial integrity of all countries and addressing the legitimate security concerns of all sides. I stress that nuclear weapons must not be used and a nuclear war must not be fought. China has delivered to Ukraine many shipments of humanitarian aid and sent its special representative many times to mediate among the countries concerned. The longer the Ukraine crisis drags on, the greater harm it will do to Europe, very important point, and the world. China hopes that peace and stability will return to Europe at an early date. We stand ready to work with France and the whole international community to find a reasonable way out of the crisis. Now, interesting that he mentions or points out France in particular, after France is the one that was basically threatening to send boots on the ground. And then finally, his final statement in the article, again, I find very interesting. He says, Confucius observes that a man of true moral integrity is one who is both friendly but independent, and who does not compromise his principles, and who is independent without any bias or taking sides. How unflinchingly firm is he in his strength? And he also quotes French writer Romain Rolland, said that it is so much easier to allow oneself to be guided than it is to think for oneself. This abdication is the kernel of the mischief. Now, for me, and I'd be really interested in your point of view, both of you, this, to me, is a message to France to secure independence from U.S. influence. He says both China and France value independence as two major countries. Our interactions in the long course of history have released tremendous energy, swaying the trajectory of the world. Now we are standing at another historical starting point. Let us join hands together on this new journey towards greater progress in China-France relations to the benefit of our two countries and the world. Very interesting content in this article.
Yes, indeed. And he was also talking then to reporters during the trip, and he was talking about the issue of Ukraine and the possibility of some kind of international peace conference on Ukraine. But he said that China would only support that if Russia was involved in that as well. Now, it's interesting that there is supposedly some kind of strange peace conference planned to take place in Switzerland, I think in the middle of June or so. And Russia's not invited, this is pretty insane. How do you hold a peace conference on Ukraine unless both parties are at it?
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely ridiculous, but I just find it very interesting, the wording of the article and what appears to be a deliberate targeting of France to uncouple it from US policy and to try and forge a way forward towards peace in Europe and in Ukraine. Very interesting.
Completely agree. And it did strike me as interesting that he chose France for the reasons that you said, because they are the country that seems to be leading the calls for boots on the ground. And we understand that some French military personnel have been killed in Ukraine over the last couple of years. So, we'll keep an eye on that and see whether France changes its direction or not. Okay, let's move on. If you like what the UKCOM does, you'd like to support us and take the extra graphic on there in the spirit it's intended. If you'd like to support us, head over to support.ukcolumn.org. Just remember that memberships are only £5 a month, and we do need your support to continue doing what we're doing. We want to do more of it. And that means involving more people. So if you can possibly help us, that would be fantastic. Do share the material you find on the various platforms, especially from ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. And you can pick something up at the UK Column shop if you would like. Now, yesterday, the interview between J. Michael Waller and Brian went out on the live stream, and that is now available on the UK Column website if you didn't get to watch it yesterday. Now, J. Michael Waller is the author of Big Intel, and he was talking about Yuri Bezmenov, and people like this. They were asking just how can the destructive teachings of Saul Alinsky appear alongside US President Obama, British Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron, and the UK Labour Party. So a very interesting and wide-ranging discussion. Tomorrow at 1 p.m, there's an interview going out with Dr. Michael Niels. He's the author of Indoctrinated Brain, and he's speaking to Brian about Alzheimer's and the effect of COVID lockdowns on the hippocampus in particular. A quick reminder that on Saturday, I will be speaking at this event in Steyning. This is Western Empire and the Great Reset. Sandy Adams will also be speaking at that event. Begins at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at the Steyning Centre. Do join us for that if you possibly can. Charles, very briefly, Julian Assange.
Yes, it's just a quick one. Today, the Odeon Cinema is showing The Trust Fall, the documentary film about the case of Julian Assange. And the important detail is that I believe Odeon Cinema will continue to run the film if attendance today is high enough. So if you're able to get down to an Odeon today to see this film, which is only today, the 8th of May, then please do, and please spread the word.
Brilliant. Thank you. Now, Vanessa, let's come back to you. And what's the latest from Rafah?
Yeah, from Gaza, but particularly from Rafah that is now under threat by Israel. This was a photo taken from Twitter, the account of Noor Naim, who was in Gaza 1 year ago to visit her family and took this very tearful photo of herself arriving at the basically the kind of, you know, the entry sector in Rafah. And then a video of IOF tanks basically entering the same crossing yesterday, if we can display the video. And just to show basically how the Israeli forces entered into that Rafah border crossing from occupied territory into the kind of the southwest area of Gaza. And let's have a look at what this dreadful man has said about it, Netanyahu. So just moving on to the next slide. So basically, he said that the entry into Rafah serves two of the main objectives of the war, returning our hostages and eliminating Hamas. And I'm sure that's why the US was allowed to veto every single ceasefire. That was not in the interest of the hostages. And he also says at the same time, we're continuing the war on Hamas. The taking of the Rafah crossing today is a very important step on the way to destroying Hamas's remaining military capabilities, including the elimination of the four terrorist battalions in Rafah, and an important step to damaging Hamas's governing capabilities. Of course, what he's talking about is potentially the control of the entire border section, which in the view of Israel will prevent the illegal importing of weapons and supplies to Hamas. But, you know, we know that every time Israel says it's destroyed Hamas battalions, when the IOF evacuates, then immediately Hamas is back in those areas and firing rockets at the occupied territory. Now, interesting here that, of course, what he's intimating in his comment is that Hamas are preventing the release of the hostages. But this is from Middle East Eye. Meanwhile, Washington and Arab capitals were dealing with the fallout of Hamas actually accepting the ceasefire proposal introduced by Qatar and Egypt on Monday, as Israel rejects the offer and pursues its offensive. So Israel is clearly not acting in the interest of the hostages. And in fact, it's reported that one of the hostages was killed yesterday in the Zionist bombing of Rafah. This is from Gaza journalist Mottasem Al-Salul. The US asked Hamas to accept the ceasefire proposal, claiming its refusal is the only obstacle ahead of ending the genocide in Gaza. Hamas accepted the ceasefire. Israeli occupation rejected the proposal. The US said that Hamas undermined the proposal and has to make more concessions, having accepted the proposal. Now, I just wanted to show, this was a video that was released yesterday of IOF forces preparing to destroy Rafah, just to give an indication of the mentality of the Israeli forces on the ground in Gaza. If we can just play that video. And then let's have a look at the effect of the IOF targeting with artillery and airplanes bombing, jet bombing of eastern Rafah. Leaflets were basically dropped telling people to evacuate to Khan Yunus. On Yunus, however, is completely destroyed. There are no services, no electricity, and no water. And yet people were fleeing eastern Rafah to try and make it to some kind of safe area. I actually spoke to friends of mine, and they said, we really don't know where to go. There's nowhere to go now. We have no escape whatsoever. And then there's a short section on a bombing of a house in eastern Rafah. It is distressing viewing, I warn people. So if we can just play this video. يا دمعة بعيني رفح يوم الدمع لما نزح طل الطحى طل الشهيد حتى الفرح كرب وجرح لما الحزن بالعشق يا الله in that family, 9 were killed, 3 survived but were very badly injured. UN agencies are putting out the message, of course, that this is a crime against humanity, as if it hasn't been a crime against humanity since the 7th of October. 600,000 children in line of fire as the IDF moves on Rafah. We had already run out of words to describe how catastrophic the situation is in Rafah, but this next chapter will take it to indescribable new levels. This is a statement from senior Hamas, which is the government in Gaza, official and spokesperson Osama Hamdan. We will not accept any deal under military pressure. We do not accept any. This is after they had accepted the ceasefire deal, by the way. We do not accept any occupation force at the Rafah crossing, which will remain a Palestinian-Egyptian crossing only. If the aggression continues, there will be no ceasefire. The Israeli army's invasion of the Rafah crossing is a crime and a dangerous escalation against a civilian facility protected by international law. Very true. The Israeli army's invasion of the Rafah crossing is a blatant attempt, to sabotage the efforts of the mediators to achieve an agreement to end the aggressions against our people. And that, of course, includes release of the hostages. And as I warned last week, guess what? The US has just completed the so-called humanitarian aid pier. Bad weather is preventing the final putting in place of the various sections of the pier. That coincides with the escalation against Rafah 1.2. million refugees inside Rafah. So clearly, it's to a degree coming true what I said, that the US and the UK will potentially be there to take refugees to Europe or to other countries that they've basically paid to accept those refugees, and that includes Egypt.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much for that, Vanessa. Now, Charles, let's come back to the UK and the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners. There's been an election.
There has, with a very thin veneer of democracy laid over the top of it. But yes, the APCC there talking about the role of the PCC. So just to recap what PCCs are, 4 started in 2012. The government say that they're responsible for the way the area is policed, the police budget, the amount of council tax charged per police, and the information you get about what local police are doing. So that's important. We'll come back to that later. But interesting, of course, to note that they've determined both the budget and the amount that's drawn from council tax. So the elections just goes to show how, in effect, since 2012, the situation's been manipulated for an almost exclusively sort of uniparty Labour Conservative result, with one exception of a Plaid Cymru seat in West Wales. But there were only six independent candidates standing, of which none got through. And part of the reason for this is that in 2023, the Electoral Commission changed the voting system in order that it's now first past the post, which it hadn't been previously. And this very much reduces the chances of a non-mainstream party candidate managing to actually be selected. The Institute for Government have put forward a piece on this, Local Elections 2024, and they talk specifically about the sort of history of it, saying that when these elections were first held in 2012, 12 independent PCCs were elected, and in 2016, three. So it's obviously been a great deterioration, if that's the way you look at it. Of course, at that time, many of those had prior experience in the criminal justice system, which you could say is a problem that we are well rid of, although it's very difficult to know which way to look at this. Nonetheless, we shall. The APCC guidance about the conduct during the pre-election period, which they refer to as purda, goes back to 2021. And they specifically talk about officials not using their public office for political purposes. And in particular, they should not use information in support of their campaign, which is not publicly available to other candidates. Now, I've been speaking to Don Gerard of the Justice and Anti-Corruption Party, who contested the PCC election in Hampshire and polled 40,000 votes. And also, I should point out on results, we've been following the candidacy of Matthew Randolph in Gloucestershire, who from a standing start polled 15,000 votes as an independent candidate. But just to return to Hampshire, we'll look at the PCC there, Donna Jones. And there is hot controversy highlighted here by the Petersfield Post paid for article in which she is seen on the 8th of March wearing a campaign rosette whilst on official business. This leaflet went out with the council tax flyer. And I refer back to what the government said about the PCC informing the public about what the police is up to, that there's no specific requirement for what the information on what the Police and Crime Commissioner is up to. So again, this went out to 800,000 households. And the questions being asked are who paid for it and is it a statement of fact or is it election campaigning? So this has been taken to the Electoral Commission, who have said that they are unable to do anything about it. But of course, it should go back to the police. Now, the problem with that is that a police complaint goes to the IOPC, the Independent Office for Public Conduct. And of course, when you submit a complaint, what happens to it? Your complaint is sent directly to the police force or organisation concerned for them to consider. So in this specific situation, a PCC, in effect, has to mark their own homework. Now, as luck would have it, or bad luck would have it, Donna Jones, who I've just been speaking about, is in fact the chair of the APCC, which is perhaps nothing short of extraordinary. And I just follow that up by saying that the Fraud Act 2006 has contained within it Section 4, the provisions within say that the breach of this section is constituted if he dishonestly abuses that position and intends by means of the abuse of that position to make a gain for himself or another. Now, with PCC salaries being in the region of £80,000 to £90,000 a year, that is looking like an interesting scenario, and one certainly that we will be following up on, because, of course, the PCCs are in a position not only to be able to fend off allegations of corruption in their own backyard, but also corruption elsewhere too.
Charles, I'm finding this interesting. The PCC role was supposed to be independent of the police, certainly, but surely it was originally intended to be independent of government as well. I mean, it's supposed to, because policing is not just about the operation of boots on the ground, it's also the implementation of government policy.
Exactly so, which is really why I draw attention to the fact that the Electoral Commission have changed the nature of the system in order that it's skewed very much against the possibility of an independent candidate getting a foot in the door. So yes, I mean, it seems to be the exactly opposite outcome of what was intended. And now there's no regard given to where that sort of sends police, you know, and what the role of police really is and how that's shaped through the force priorities and all the other things that that the Police and Crime Commissioner can have influence over.
Yes, okay. Well, let's move on then to private prosecutions.
Yeah, absolutely. And this does follow neatly in the sort of central question is what do police actually do these days? And I'll just go back one slide. Reported here by The Telegraph that there's been a first in a private prosecution for a case of burglary. Now, the specifics of the case are not especially noteworthy, perhaps, but this is being conducted by an organisation called TMI, shown here with their prolific crimes team. And they describe themselves as being at the forefront of carrying out criminal investigations, culminating in private criminal prosecutions for those who deal in illicit goods. So specifically sort of shoplifting and theft. But they what they really highlight is that they will deal with these offences where the police or the CPS will not do so. Now, the CPS was formed in 1986 and essentially found that middle ground between police and the court. So it wasn't really that long ago. And the what they have to say about private prosecutions is that they're conducted by people who are not acting on behalf of the police or another prosecuting authority. And the right to bring private prosecutions has certain limitations, and these are critical. Underneath the Prosecution of Offences Act 1985, the Director of Public Prosecutions, DPP, has power under Section 6 to take over private prosecutions. Now, when one considers what happened when Keir Starmer was DPP and Jimmy Savile was under investigation, that is worth considering. They go on to say that the fact that a private prosecution succeeds is not an indication that the case should have been prosecuted by the CPS. And indeed, there are instances where it is appropriate for the CPS to exercise the director's power either to continue the prosecution or to discontinue or stop it. Now, going back to sort of what police are doing, we're looking at the funding, and we see on the right-hand column, 2024, funding's gone up to 17.6 billion. But the government are declaring at the same time that they plan to save 38 million hours of police time, which sounds like a work of fiction. But nonetheless, in response to the policing productivity review, of course, what they're really doing is saying that they want to be using more technology. So they're talking about live facial recognition and drones that will be used as first responders. Now, my reaction to that, sort of having had first-hand experience of it, is that sounds like a complete waste of time, money, and effort. But they go on to talk about knife detection and artificial intelligence. So effectively, a complete over-reliance on technology, including automatic redaction and translation. Now, that there is a case for that. Redaction takes an incredibly long time, very, very inefficient process. But to use AI, it's probably not necessarily the only possibility there. And then they end with an amazing conditional by saying that if just 500,000 office hours were saved, the review estimates that officers in England could attend an additional 250,000 incidents of domestic abuse or over 300,000 burglaries. Now, the point to consider here is what really are the police for? And over recent years, we've seen them enforce COVID restrictions when there was absolutely no operational requirement to do so, to give two-tier policing when it comes to protests against or in favour of Black Lives Matter, on trans issues, and a whole host of other things besides, particularly in the Israel-Palestine situation at the minute. So it very much looks like real sort of criminal prosecutions are looking towards being privatized. But of course, this is bearing in mind those specific limitations where the director of public prosecutions is able to stop anything that is in effect not politically expedient.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Now we will move on to online safety briefly. So if we just put this on screen, because this is the graphic that Ofcom has put up for their latest release, which is entitled Tech Firms Must Tame Toxic Algorithms to Protect Children Online. And the graphic that they've chosen, the photograph that they've chosen, is of a toddler. And of course, when we come to look at the actual text of this, they're not talking about toddlers. So they are giving the image that children are toddlers, but then we're talking about older children, in fact. So they're calling this a reset for children's safety. The Online Safety Act, they say, imposes strict new duties on services that can be accessed by children, including popular social media sites and apps and search engines. Now, I would make the point that social media, in their terms and conditions, say very clearly that children under the age of 13 are not allowed to access those. And the Online Safety Act requires services to enforce their terms and conditions. So it's going to be very interesting. I'm not quite sure how that works with the graphic that they showed, but they said that our draft codes, if we put that up, are much greater use, expect much greater use of highly effective age assurance so that services know which of their users are children in order to keep them safe. And this is the bottom line here. This is ushering in digital identity. Because they are going to have to require social media companies to check the age of the people using the service. And of course, that won't just apply to children, because how do social media companies know that the person is a child and therefore needs to be challenged on their age? They will be challenging everybody on their age. The report goes on to say this: under our proposals, any service which operates a recommender system, that's an algorithm, that is at higher risk of harmful content, must also use highly effective age assurance to identify who their child users are. As I say, they can only do that if they're challenging everybody. And they produce this nice little graphic to tell us exactly what the services are going to have to do. This is ushering in digital ID, of course. Now, Charles, back to you then. We're looking at AI in cars.
We are, although sort of to follow your segment, really, we're not particularly looking at AI and we're not really particularly looking at cars. We're looking at what this enables. But yes, yesterday the government announced through the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology that there's a £1 billion investment into what they're calling AI for self-driving cars, if you can imagine that. This is the AI, the Wave AI, tweeted here by Michelle Donnellan, who spent some time there with Rishi Sunak looking at the kit on offer. Now, Wave themselves, of course, are very keen to put forward their safety credentials, and they talk about the system learning to predict and adapt in order that they embed safety into AI's core, which of course is written by humans, building an emergency response safety reflex. So there are a number of concerns that come out from this, which we won't have time to go into all of today, but the Scientific American went back a couple of years, 2022, asking the very reasonable question, who is liable when AI kills? And in order to run this through, they used an example from 2018 when a pedestrian was killed by a self-drive Uber vehicle. Now, driver error was at issue, but the AI failed to detect the pedestrian. Of course, there's so many other mistakes that could be made with catastrophic consequences. An AI-based mental health chatbot encouraged a simulated suicidal patient to take her own life. Female resume applicants are being discriminated against. And in one particularly dramatic case, an AI algorithm misidentified a suspect in an aggravated assault. And yet people are still banging the drum for AI. Now, the other thing I want to bring to your attention is a geofence, which you may not necessarily have heard of, but this is from Verizon. And it describes a geofence as being a virtual fence or perimeter around a physical location. Like a real fence, a geofence creates a separation between that location and the area around it. Unlike a real fence, geofencing technology can also detect movement of mobile devices inside the virtual boundary. So when I said it wasn't really about cars, what I meant is that cars are now really being recategorized as mobile devices. And the government have been putting content out about this for a couple of years at least. First of all, the Geospatial Commission with DCIT, Finding the Way Forward, Location Data to Enable Connected and Automated Mobility. And they talk specifically about regulating vehicle behavior. But of course, in a driverless car, it's not the vehicle behavior, really. We're talking about the behavior of people, and in particular, enforcing transport-related regulations. And here we go. Geofencing will play an important role in optimizing the early deployment of self-driving vehicles, which is exactly what government's talking about yesterday and today. Indeed, there was a competition back in 2022 in which optimizing geofencing talk again about changing behavior and how geospatial data can be used to reduce emissions. So in effect, just engaging with a particular narrative and then nudging people's behavior in a particular direction, which of course puts us in mind of the behavioral insights team. It's exactly the sort of area in which they have been working and will work. Now, in America, they've been ahead of this. And we see from the 10th Amendment Center, the California Assembly passed a bill to restrict location tracking via geofencing. And this was in 2023. They're not the only state to have done it. But they point out that the technique allows police to search broad areas and identify every electronic device in the area. So an incredible surveillance tool. The use of Google location data to engage in massive phishing expeditions and subject hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people to police location tracking. Now, this really is the issue at hand. And if you think that you're not going to be subject to it, you might have to think again when you go outside and look at your car, because this is just an example from the Hyundai website. They talk about their Bluelink safeguard alerts, and they specifically have a geofence alert, which is a feature, of course, they suggest it's to your advantage. It allows you to set boundaries for allowed areas and restricted areas for your vehicle to drive. You will be notified if your vehicle exits an allowed area or enters a restricted area. Now, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility to imagine that it might not necessarily be you that's setting the allowed or the restricted area. So as I say, this is not really about cars and it's not really about AI. It is an awful lot about control and surveillance, and we'll be watching the direction this goes in with a fair idea of what it's going to be.
And of course, it would remove the need for ULEZ cameras, I suspect. But anyway, we'll talk more about this in extra. Vanessa, let's come back to you. And we want to talk about the lovely Hamish de Breton Gordon.
Yes, Hamish de Breton Gordon, the go-to for the Telegraph and the BBC and every single mainstream media outlet for your chemical weapon fiction, I would say. So this was a headline in The Telegraph. I've seen firsthand how deadly Putin's chemical weapons can be, Hamish de Breton Gordon, with a very stylized image on the front of that article. And then let's have a look at what he says in the article. I don't recommend reading it. It's really utterly pointless. With the statesmen of the West busy trying to avoid the escalation, I would disagree. Putin and his gangsters threaten on an almost daily basis. Russia has hoodwinked our leaders into ignoring the chemical threat. It's clear to me that over the last 12 months, Russian forces have been using chemical weapons on an industrial scale and with great effect, and they are making tangible gains across the front. And I'm sure that's the only reason they're making tangible gains across the front when hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have been sent to their deaths. Now, what does he then say? This did actually kind of really make me giggle at the end of the article. So one third of the article is basically pushing gas masks. It is very clear what our government should do now. The weapons Putin is using are potent only for minutes. You don't need fancy suits or boots and gloves to protect against them. Just a decent gas mask. Why did this make me laugh? Well, if we move on, this is in WikiSpook, but I mean, it's registered pretty much everywhere on information on de Breton Gordon. He previously had a company called Secure Bio, and then later another company called Avon, both of which manufactured gas masks. He doesn't mention that the company, which I think is Secure Bio, was dissolved in August 2017 with debts of over $715,000. But you do actually see him pushing the gas mask PR in Syria also. And then I would recommend everybody looks at the Berlin Group 21 PDF on the chemical weapon attacks in Syria, or rather the non-chemical weapon attacks in Syria. And this is back in, when was this? In 2013, Piers Robinson, who has been instrumental in exposing both the corruption of the OPCW and the fabrication of chemical weapon attacks in Syria to, of course, justify foreign intervention led by the US and the UK. So he talks about the problem of unreliable evidence and manipulated reports as being ubiquitous throughout. For example, in 2013, prior to Ghouta, British allegations were based upon covert MI6 operations involving a former British military officer, Hamish de Breton Gordon. The subsequent joint UN-OPCW investigation stated that Sheikh Maksoud could not be corroborated. And so an MI6 sample gathering operation in conjunction with Anthony Lloyd, who of course was the author that we reported as having falsely declared that he had interviewed Hezbollah operatives very early on in the conflict with Israel since October the 7th for the time. So doubling up there. And this was followed up, of course, by various media outlets, including the New York Times. US accuses Russia of using chemical weapons in Ukraine. The State Department said Russia had used chloroquine in various instances and more stylized photographs throughout the NYT article. Funnily enough, the Western corrupted OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, has itself said there is an insufficient claim of chemical weapons use in Ukraine. And of course, it's been very strenuously denied by the Russian State Department.
Yes, thank you, Vanessa. Thank you. Now, we're going to just finish with a lighter topic, because maybe we could describe this as a chemical weapon in its own sense. But I just wanted to highlight this because this is the Department for Energy, Security and Net Zero, who are busy getting very excited about carbon capture and storage. So I'm just going to read the first paragraph of their press release. Millions of tons of captured carbon dioxide could be transported via road, rail, barge or ship, revolutionizing the way it reaches offshore storage sites, helping more businesses cut emissions. So they're even talking about importing carbon dioxide from other countries so it can be pumped under the sea off the coast of the UK, because the best thing that we can do, the most productive way that we can create jobs, is to transport air from one place to another so that it can be pumped into a hole in the ground, well, under the sea. They have started a consultation on this. This is the headline if you want to go looking for it. CCUS, that's carbon capture and storage, non-pipeline transport and cross-border CO2 networks call for evidence. So they are wanting evidence from individuals and organizations that might be interested in this. I would suggest that the best evidence that that they could be given is a call to stop this nonsense. It is unbelievable. But don't worry, it's gonna maintain 50,000 jobs in the UK. So what more can we ask for? Right, we got to leave it there for today. Thank you very much to Vanessa and Charles for joining me today. Thank you all for watching. Now, we'll be back in a few minutes for some extra, and we have some video which might shock a few people. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.